Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name's Ashley Williams. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a community organizer here, and I work with trans folks of color, and we do a lot of prison abolition and gender justice-based work that involves direct action and political education. And then I work for Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective as the North Carolina coordinator.
So you're in North Carolina. So right now we're looking at what some people are calling a repeal of the notorious anti-trans HB2, but the story is not quite that simple. Could you tell us about what went on with this sort of non-repeal repeal?
I mean, when I think about HB2 and when I talk about it, I like to remind folks that HB2 started as a retaliation against the Charlotte City Council for including gender and sexual orientation into our non-discrimination ordinance. So I want to say it was like 2 days later HB2 was introduced and quickly voted on, and it kind of moved through very quickly. So I think of organizing in Charlotte and in North Carolina, we were all very surprised and concerned, but also ready to like get to work. And so there you saw a lot of direct action and rapid response work. But on the back end, you know, we were trying to be more strategic and implement some political education too.
Yeah.
That looked like moving our community's consciousness forward around trans identities and the intersections of like race, gender, sexuality, class on a trans person. And contextually in North Carolina and in the South and south of the Mason-Dixon line, and just kind of some of the geographical things. And so I think we did a lot of good, and we learned a lot about what doesn't work in terms of dealing with the right, the GOP, white supremacists, and also liberals. And so we've still been kind of focusing our work around that. And so we had an HB2 kind of like teach-in, or kind of where are we at now, about a week before this non-repeal repeal. At that point, we knew that trans folks were going to like be harmed the most from this bill, as they have been throughout the beginning of the talks of the non-discrimination ordinance. It was just a matter of time, right? So the NCAA, we knew that the NCAA had to make a decision about whether they were going to have those next 7 games or the games for the next 7 years in North Carolina. And we knew that, I want to say April the 18th was their deadline. And so I was figuring that the legislature was kind of going to give the NCAA a little bit of time if it was the case that they did not repeal HB2. And so, I mean, we're closely watching and trying to prepare for some rapid response things. A lot of folks that I know who work for the ACLU and at the legislature, they were telling it, the messages were mixed, even for the policy heads, even for the folks who like spend a lot of time trying to understand the critical moment that was that night where the GOP leads were like, we have made a decision, and that's the only thing they said. So no one really knew what to expect. And so the next morning, I mean, folks were really devastated. We didn't think that was the repeal that was going to happen, although we were more afraid of how liberals were going to take the repeal, right? Like, we knew that if there was any inch of them saying this repeal is good, that we were going to have more work to do. And so that's where I think, I mean, right now, that's where we're definitely at, trying to reconfigure some targets. So for me personally, I'm not interested in going after Democrats or Republicans, like in a strategic way through, you know, direct action or anything. But I know that is still an opportunity for us to push folks and to inform our communities about who's running in the fall. But I am kind of interested in like targeting the NCAA, for example, some of these other associations who continue to bring business back to North Carolina, even in spite of what they said before. That's a big deal for me, because the way I understand these economic boycotts long term is like a corporation such as the NCAA is not going to like not have basketball in states because of anti-trans legislation. They would lose too much money. So I'm thinking that, you know, these economic boycotts are going to become less sexy and less of a problem. And they're just going to be non-existent. Like, it's going to happen.
Right.
And I worry about that for states that are not North Carolina.
You had mentioned, you know, learning a lot of lessons about what did work and what didn't work. I'd love for you to expand on that a little bit about some things that that were successful and some things that have been less so.
Yeah, definitely. Before HB2 was a thing, there was a lot of kind of resisting the nonprofit industrial complex in various ways, specifically resisting things like tokenization, which is probably one of the most prevalent things, and just kind of trans antagonistic practices of nonprofits. And so because of HB2 passing, in the beginning, lots of money was coming into the state for alleged organizing, but none of the grassroots groups who dealt with the communities that were the most impacted, namely Black trans folks, we were seeing none of that money. We were seeing none of those resources. And so what we did see was that those resources were going to the big dogs like ACLU, HRC, and then Equality NC, which is North Carolina's HRC. And so there were also, you know, first attempts to work together, and people were tokenized. People were certainly tokenized before HB2 was a thing, just like being a person of color and being a queer person wanting to, you know, work for a nonprofit. They were exploited at that point, but we just saw a lot of the big dogs just really not giving a fuck and really screwing people over. And so so not only were we resisting, like, the right, we had to resist kind of inwardly liberals, Democrats, people who were not talking about the kinds of repeals that would benefit Black trans folks. You saw a lot of organizers going into communities not referring to how this is a trans antagonistic piece of legislation. And so for us, that was a big deal, right? A major part of our organizing, especially when we talk about who's the most impacted from HB2. So, I mean, I think one of the lessons that we learned is still, like, working with the big gogs is not an option for us. We're not a risk that we want to take, rather. I think around direct action, we mobilized a lot more folks, and we were able to kind of introduce people to what the possibilities of direct action. We were doing anything from kind of, you know, the Moral Monday protests, gathering all those folks on the lawn, but we would have kind of pre-mobilization training who would bring people in who normally wouldn't do a direct action. Letter writing campaigns, you know, things that folks could do from their desks or from their homes. So our organizing, I think, got better around those tactics.
North Carolina has been sort of ground zero for all sorts of these really atrocious repressive right-wing attacks for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
And so HB2, you know, when I think of these things, I think of how they all connect. So I'm thinking of HB2 mm-hmm. happening in the context of really atrocious voter suppression, which, of course, is targeted at Black people in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And attacks on labor, attacks on teachers who are mostly, again, women. And so, I would love for you to talk about the way these things have all connected and this, what it's been like being under the boot of this kind of massive repression on all levels.
It's been difficult, right? So our HB2 resistance, especially kind of when we had to go toe-to-toe with people who we thought were on our side at one point, that definitely made us targets in our community. And so there wasn't a lot of support there.
Yeah.
But again, like, a risk we were willing to take. Also there were, and then so something like Charlotte Uprising happened. And then, so about 2 weeks in, people started to ask, like, who the hell, what is Charlotte Uprising? Who are these people? And for us, it was like, ooh, we get to, like, talk about how we are Black and trans. And we get to talk about, like, how when we resisted the corporatization of something like Charlotte Pride, it was very much tied to our issues and our demands around the uprising. So that was really wonderful to be able to, that's actually when we started doing the Trans 101s in Charlotte. Other cities in North Carolina had done those things, but we hadn't tried to, so no back. It was just good for us to, like, do that and be able to say, like, Charlotte Uprising is made out of the folks who have always been resisting things in Charlotte. And we were able to talk about how, you know, it's no surprise that Black trans folks are kind of on the front lines, but also behind the scenes, as we have been pushed so far to the margins that we have no other way to kind of speak than to act, if you will. So that, I mean, that is something that's really, when I take a step back and think about all the stuff that we've done, that's like a big thing for me.
Yeah, and so let's talk about the Charlotte Uprising. So it's been a little over 6 months, right, since Keith Lamont Scott was killed and since the Charlotte Uprising began. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about the past 6 months.
The past 6 months have, it still feels like a blur, right? So, again, it's that same group of around, like, 10 trans folks of color organizing all the things. And so Charlotte Uprising happened, and then one of our friends who is a Black trans woman was brutalized in Charlotte and then criminalized, like, because hate speech legislation never protects those who are the most impacted by hate speech or, like, acts that are hateful. We went into, like, organizing mode around that, like, more specifically, but still just doing that project stuff. So we feel like we haven't had a break. So I'm tired. Things were going really good until issues around money came up, right? Like, there was money being poured into the state. There was also a bail fund that we were pulling money from. So there's only one bail fund in North Carolina right now. And we were pulling money from that, but we were also raising money, like, for operational purposes. And so we were able to raise a lot of money for that. There was money being poured in. And so there came a time where the needs of the uprising looked like, we need to house people, we need to get people out of jail, and we need to, like, help people get lawyers in a way that requires money. The fiscal sponsor that we were using for the uprising kind of, it was an issue. There was tension there. There was tension around, like, how we were bringing negative attention on to the fiscal sponsor. And so that meant for them, I think that they were not going to, like, allow us to use our money in certain ways. And so for us, it was a really big deal. Still a really big deal. And I think we also kind of learned a lot about what it can look like to not kind of work through the usual, okay, the police kill a Black person, nonprofits try to work with the grassroots folks, but they end up shitting on them. And so we have to figure something else out. And maybe that means that, like, you don't have all your money, like, all the money that you raise, like, you no longer can use it, or the ways in which these organizations or fiscal sponsors or nonprofits operated with you were just transactionally or just kind of conditional. And so we continue to, like, support folks who are still in jail from the uprising. There are still folks who are incarcerated, namely because they don't have addresses there. They don't have homes, and so the police can't, like, track where they are if they let them out. And then folks who just had really poor legal representation. We still are organizing, going, like, really hard around Raekwon Boreham, who was framed by CMPD. The community, as well as the police, right, and the city government continue to paint us as, like, these conspiracy theorists around, like, well, the police, you know, they have hard evidence that they did not kill Justin Carr, but there's so many people, you know, walking around every day who know what they saw that night. So we're definitely being gaslit, but we're still organizing. Like, we can't slow down. Right. The Black trans woman that I mentioned is, you know, facing court really soon. And so we've been working really hard to make sure she has adequate legal representation. And we continue to do our trans 101 and, kind of rapid response things. But what I would like to see for us, who are still organizing. So a lot of people are burnt out and, like, have not returned to the organizing scene, like, haven't returned to actions, even just to participate in, you know, teach-ins or anything. And again, the work is on those Black and trans femme folks. And so it's been rough, like, being gaslit and then not having as many hands on deck. There were definitely interpersonal things that transpired that caused people not to want to organize right now in the same way that just went unresolved. But I think for a small group of us, we are still kind of in the rapid response mode of, like, we are in a crisis. We're still in crisis.
the election of Trump sort of shifts where people are looking in terms of where organizing is happening, where sort of the more spectacular resistance is happening or not. And so it's always really important to remind people that these, especially, I think especially in places like Charlotte, where there was a brief period of time where the pictures were everywhere, the news was constantly paying attention, and then, you know, the attention span dries up, that the long-term effects of these sort of spectacular moments of resistance, they're really hard, and there's not any good answer other than people need long-term support.
Yeah, but also wanted to say something about the Charlotte Opportunity Task Force, who, so, you know, that study was done, I can't remember if it was Stanford or Harvard, but a study was done, and the outcome was such that if you're born poor in Charlotte, you'll most likely stay poor for your entire life. And so this came out, I want to say, either very close to the uprising. I can't remember before or after. And so, again, I was hoping that the Charlotte Opportunity Task Force, which is the group that the so-called community and the city government put together to kind of attend to these things. They have this long report that talks about like what they see the issues are, right? And so for us, like, they aren't using words like, in Charlotte, the police kill Black people, or in Charlotte, you know, a lot of folks go to community college, but they're not supported academically, or, you know, in Charlotte, there's geographic segregation that's based on race and class. Like, it didn't talk about like the role that white supremacy plays. And so there have been times where the city almost like put a lot of money on like a soccer field or something. And folks kind of, this was like in November, I want to say, and folks were kind of like, whoa, how can you put money on a soccer field when all this stuff just happened this summer and no one's putting money into like something that can better the racial relations in the city? And so again, we saw those nonprofits, they're the organizations that have really close ties to the state, right? Like, they popped up and they're like, oh, we're going to raise a lot of money and like heal Charlotte in ways that our organizing is not legible to, right? So I want to say they raised like millions of dollars so that some organizations and individuals could come up with like these plans and programs for Charlotte. Things that look a lot like the organizing we've already been doing. And so I feel really insulted acknowledging that, like, we are never going to be as legible as something like the United Way in terms of, like, implementing programming into our community with money that the city government gave us, right? Like, they're not going to give us anything. They don't listen to us. They don't value our lives. Like, we can't participate in these things. So we've seen a lot of that, too. And we think that I feel like folks have forgotten, or maybe they don't see the impact of the uprising in the way that I see it.
That the revolution will not be funded, right? It's a story we sort of know, but each time it happens in a slightly different and more frustrating way. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about reproductive justice and trans people placing reproductive justice, which gets lost a lot. I literally just got a press release today from Texas that the deal that the legislature there wants to make is a compromise where they get to have their quote-unquote bathroom bill if they get to keep funding for Planned Parenthood, which is just it's so telling, right, of the way that they you know, those in power will play one off against the other. Yeah, so I would love for you to just talk a little bit more about your reproductive justice work and why trans people belong in reproductive justice work and why it's necessary to understand these two things as not two things at all.
I don't know if we're at the place where those things are not two things, right? Like, in order for those things to not be two things, we need folks on both sides acknowledging that. And I don't think that we have that right now, right? So I was really excited about being able to articulate how something like gender injustice is a matter of reproductive oppression using the language of RJ. But also something like the Flint water crisis is reproductive oppression, again, using the same language, and the killing of Keith Lamont Scott, right? Like removing a father from not only his family, but from his community. That's an issue for everyone, and it's definitely an issue that everyone should be concerned with, that for me is still about control and exploitation.
And I want to say that I got this job kind of right after the uprising, working for Sister Song.
I was happy to get the job, but I was a little worried about how I was going to remain accountable to my folks, my, like, Black trans folks who I continue to organize with.
For me, they've really been supporting me on ways that I can make, like, bring RJ to them and help them see that RJ has a lot of work to do, but there's a lot of opportunity, right? I have done nothing but be transparent about, like, where I think things are right now. I just read the first couple pages of Loretta Ross's new book, and she is one of the folks who, you know, really birthed, if you will, this movement for reproductive justice, and along with another person, other people, but she wrote the book with another person. And I read it, and I still honestly feel, I've read the first couple pages, and I'm like, so in their introduction, they have a section for gender and language. So they talk about the ways in which, I just felt like the language was really cis-centered. And so it said things like, you know, we acknowledge that not everyone's body has the capability to get pregnant, and that, like, there are folks who might not want to get pregnant who are women and trans folks, right? And then it would still kind of, like, fall back on, you know, there is something to say about, like, how cis women experience reproductive oppression. And I don't deny that, right? I think that's true. But I think that there's a better way to frame who's the most impacted. And for me, that's not cis women. And I see a lot of, like, I think, so the nonprofit industrial complex, like, puts this precarious stuff on organizations that make them try to look different on paper from another organization, or that make them compete for funding or clarity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that those things have negatively impacted, like, everyone's organization who wants to do something good, like, in the name of reproductive justice. But yesterday I was at CLIP, which is, like, an RJ conference in Amherst, Massachusetts, and there was a Black trans woman on the panel, and, like, I saw how folks were responding to her in a trans antagonistic way in terms of, like, how she spoke about how, like, bringing two trans women to a conference is not centering them because they are surrounded by, like, cis bodies. She also talked about the very real fear of, like, organizing with cis folks, things like that. And so I was, like, really excited that she shared those things. In ways that I think people can't hear from me because I'm a non-binary trans femme. Like, so people are just like, no, you're definitely still a girl type stuff. And so, and it's just really hard. And I met other non-binary folks who work for RJ organizations, and we spent a long time, like, talking and connecting about how does this feel to do this work? It feels like it's all about the body, which it is, and we know that, you know, folks experience violence at the sight of their bodies, but, like, how can we keep it growing and keep it going? I think that continuing to make trans issues a side issue is not going to get us there. Or it could be that RJ is just like, look, this isn't about trans women. Like, I think trans folks would appreciate that too. Like, cut the shit.
So I want to wrap up because you gave this really excellent talk that I was watching on Facebook at a conference recently about bodies and direct action. And I would love if you could give us a very, very abbreviated version of that conversation, because I thought it was a really fascinating way to talk about direct action, which is a thing more and more people are moving towards doing these days.
Thanks. So I wrote that paper because I was so sick of, in activist spaces, not being seen as a dancer, and then in organizing spaces or in dance spaces, not being seen as an organizer. And so I wanted to kind of bring my two worlds together and that they're not separate worlds. I wanted to show folks that we are all movers. As long as parts of our bodies are moving, like, we are inherently movers, and there's performances happening all around us. I use some frameworks that dance kind of gives me, so dance studies and performance theory, to think about what people are doing in direct actions. And so for me, interlocutors is what I call, like, folks who are direct action practitioners. I think that with their bodies, they are, like, positing that the state, like, has to stop killing Black people, and that in some instances they can't kill Black people, like, in ways that we show noncompliance in direct actions. Yeah. And then I think to people who are non-state audiences, like folks who are on their way to work in the morning, and they're like, what is this line of people in the road? Or folks who are like, why are you always doing the things that you're doing? And I think we're saying to them, like, join us. Like, you should be a part of this too. And I think direct action is really effective, and I'm excited about it as a tactic. I love training blockades, and I love talking to people about how what are the possibilities if we treat direct action like a performance? Like, what does it mean that we would prepare differently? Does it mean that we wouldn't prepare? What about, I'm thinking of something called Chance Dance that John Cage is known for, and it's like there is a moment at the beginning of the performance that a choice is made around, like, which performance it's going to be. And for me, like, direct actions are similar to that, right? Like, we can't always know what's going to happen way ahead of time. We have these skills. We have these techniques, right? But we're going to have to decide how to use them in the moment. And for me, it's the same language. It's the same thing. But it's also that, you know, art has the ability to reach folks in ways that other methods do not. And I wondered what it would be like if we thought seriously about direct action as a performance of resistance. And art is something that's really close to Black organizing.
Awesome. So how can people keep up with you and your work?
You can follow me on Twitter at @ash_bash23. And, I mean, you could be my Facebook friend, and you'll probably get a message about a teach-in or an action that's coming up. I'm also, like, thinking about getting back into writing more, more seriously. I'm not in graduate school anymore, so that's a real possibility for me. But folks should, like, look out for that.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.